The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
Shaka Fatah Jr. called former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell to the stand today as a witness in his tax and bank fraud trial. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, it's part of Fatah's larger strategy to call on high-profile, satisfied customers to try to discredit the government's case.
Rendell answered just a handful of questions from Fatah in the courtroom, and here was the gist.
All I know is what he did for me. That's the only time I've ever spent any time with him, and he did a good job.
Rendell was talking there to reporters after his testimony. He said there's no question Fatah ran a legitimate business when he took photographs under the name Photography the year Rendell ran for governor.
He handled people very nicely. He got photographs to people quickly. And he had a lot of personal, charm and an easy manner.
Rendell told prosecutors he knows nothing about Fatah's other company, 259 Strategies. The government says that outfit defrauded banks, the IRS, and the Philadelphia School District out of hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So in terms of 259 Strategies, I would just say that, the government is incorrect. Over time, I changed the name of my business. The bottom line is it's a name change.
Fatah, the son of indicted Congressman Shaka Fatah Sr., says the government's case amounts to paperwork discrepancies.
I started with photography. I started making money. I got to a limit. I figured out another way to make money, and that's what you're going to see for the rest of this case.
He plans to bring in former Mayor John Street, who will also testify as a happy customer.
I'm going to keep showing people that over the years, all I've done is figure out how to make money. If you heard their opening statement, I think they said that I was sitting around eating pizza. Well, guess what? I was eating pizza, but I was making a lot of money. That's what I'm going to show. I got to go, Bobby.
Fatah stands accused of 23 fraud counts, cheating on his taxes, and lying to federal agents. He decided to forego a public defender and fight the charges alone. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The state of New Jersey remains a work in progress 3 years after Superstorm Sandy devastated coastal communities. Let's look at recovery efforts to date with NJ Spotlight Sandy recovery writer Scott Gurry. And Scott, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
A startling number in the report that you brought to light was a mere 2,000 of the 8,000 families in New Jersey's largest homeowner grant program have completed construction and are back in their homes. Are there easy answers to account for the delay?
It depends how you look at the numbers. There are some impressive ways that the state has framed it. They've said that they're now giving about $7 million out to homeowners and about 50 homes are being completed every week. And to be clear, the vast majority of those 8,000 people in the state's grant program have now gotten at least some money, at least an initial check to start rebuilding. But of course, in the end, all that matters to people is that they complete construction, that they're done with everything and able to move back into their homes. And by that metric, as you said, just 2,000 out of the total 8,000 are completed at this point, 3 years after the storm. There have been a number of delays for all sorts of reasons. There's a lot of finger pointing going around. There were problems early on, as has been reported, with the contractor that the state hired to manage this grant program. Accounts of people's paperwork getting lost, misfiled, people being incorrectly denied funding initially, and then they were finally, after lawsuits, people were allowed to apply again, and then they were accepted the second time around. So all of these sorts of problems have made the recovery drag on and on, not to mention other sorts of issues such as the flood insurance scandal, where people claimed they were shortchanged coverage for their flood insurance claims. So all of these sorts of things have made the recovery process drag on and on. Here we are 3 years after the storm, and really it seems like there's still quite a long way to go.
8,000 families in the state's largest homeowner grant program, but clearly that's not the total number of families who have felt the devastation of the storm.
Right. There's many more than that. That figure, for example, doesn't include secondary homeowners, people who have vacation homes along the Jersey Shore. They were ineligible to apply for this grant program. There's tens of thousands of renters, many of them low income, who would have applied for other programs, but not necessarily this one. And then there's a lot of people who initially applied for this grant program and were either denied for one reason or another, or, you know, the process has dragged on so long and they've since given up and dropped out.
And I believe it was a year back when NJ Spotlight looked to the experience with New Orleans and Katrina to see if there were applicable lessons. Were there, and moving forward in the event of a future storm, how can New Jersey hope to proceed more efficiently?
Every time we have a big disaster like this, we try to apply the lessons from the past disaster. Among the lessons we've found are that the state needs to provide more oversight over these contractors that they hired so that small problems don't mushroom into much larger ones. I've reached out to a number of other individuals who have been closely involved with the Sandy recovery for this anniversary. They had a variety of possible solutions. They've said that you need to have a more defined and coherent strategy going into the disaster recovery so all the parts fit together better and small problems, again, don't turn into larger ones. Storm victims should have been allowed to fill out a single application for all the grant programs instead of the tons of paperwork and bureaucracy they ended up dealing with, which turned into headaches and frustration from everyone involved. Another important suggestion was that people should have been assigned individual caseworkers to help them walk through the recovery from start to finish rather than having to navigate this complicated process all by themselves.
You're speaking to efficiencies in subsequent recovery processes. Has much been done, though, looking at more permanent solutions, namely whether it's appropriate to continue to offer these kind of recovery efforts, be they dunes or elevating homes in communities that are susceptible to having repeated flooding?
Well, that's a whole other big question and a very controversial one. It's difficult telling people if they live somewhere along the coast that maybe it's just not a good idea to rebuild in this place. You've been flooded so many times, we keep essentially bailing you out. And this place probably never should have been built in to begin with. Plus, you know, you have climate change and the sea level rise on top of that. So really the only way to get people to move in a situation like that is to offer buyouts. And buyout funding has been fairly limited in the state and in many places. But, you know, more and more environmentalists and planning advocates are saying that in the end, you know, people are going to have to accept these hard realities. They're going to have to move on, and they just can't live in some of these places.
Scott, thanks so much for shedding light on the latest in this situation.
Thank you, Dave.
NJ Spotlight Sandy recovery writer Scott Gurian. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. While government responses to Sandy rebuilding have been slow in the 3 years since the storm, insurance companies have moved forward. They're paying more attention to climate change and are incorporating climate modeling and analysis when calculating future risks and how much to charge for coverage, as WHYY's Carolyn Beeler reports.
Dennis Segru from Standard & Poor's Rating Services says the biggest names in insurance have geologists, biologists, and meteorologists on staff to model future risk.
A lot of these larger, more sophisticated insurance companies are investing quite heavily in trying to understand extreme weather events and really be in touch with the most up-to-date scientific thinking as regards climate change.
Following Sandy and Katrina, increasingly smaller companies started adding climate change computer modeling to their risk projections. Insurance Information Institute President Bob Hartwig says flooding from those storms served as a wake-up call.
It's absolutely the case that insurers did take all of this into account. The state of modeling associated with storm surge, for instance, has advanced significantly over the past 3 years.
Still, Max Maservi from the Sustainability Advocacy Group Ceres says while the industry may be planning for climate change, it's not talking about it in public yet.
Well, it matters that insurance companies won't use the term climate change because it can really muddy the public conversation that's occurring.
Standard & Poor's Segru says climate projections aren't really increasing insurance premiums yet. That's because changes are projected to occur in the future while policies for, say, homeowners insurance are written for a year at a time. I'm Carolyn Beeler, WHYY News.
There are not a lot of competitive races on the ballot in Philadelphia next Tuesday, though one normally quiet race is shaping up to be a hotly contested battle. WHYY's Dave Davies reports on five Republicans vying for two city council seats.
There are 7 at-large seats on Philadelphia City Council, and the city charter effectively limits the majority party to 5, which usually means the Republicans win 2 seats. Typically, 5 Republican candidates run against each other, and the 2 incumbents win. But this year, it doesn't look like a cakewalk for the 2 GOP council at-large members seeking re-election.
Created tens of thousands of jobs in Philadelphia around cancer.
Poverty rates have increased. The unemployment rate is off the
well. If you look at your neighborhoods in Center City,
that was incumbent Councilman Denny O'Brien encountering plenty of flack at a recent debate. This year, you can make a case that any of the 5 Republicans running for those 2 slots has a shot. Both O'Brien and fellow incumbent David O have opposition among city Republican leaders, partly because of positions they've taken, such as refusing to insist on hearings on the sale of the city-owned utility, the Philadelphia Gas Works, and partly because they're perceived as failing to tend to political relationships. O'Brien says he's heard this before.
4 years ago, I wasn't endorsed. I wasn't endorsed this time. But I believe I have a political brain, and I've demonstrated that I know how to use it. But I also have a political brand that's connected to that. And I would hope that instead of the Republican Party walking away from it, they'll embrace it.
O'Brien was the Republicans' lead vote-getter 4 years ago, and his 30 years in the state legislature and name recognition in Northeast Philadelphia put him in a relatively strong position. But David O, who was elected 4 years ago, has hit some speed bumps. Earlier this year, the city ethics board fined O $2,000 after he instructed a political donor to route a large contribution through another political committee to evade the city's contribution limits. O says it was only a technical violation and that he thought what he was doing was a legal way to work around the city's campaign finance law.
I'm clear on what the law is. I think the issue is that my understanding of the law is that's proper. The ethics board has a different opinion, but I'm not going to argue about it.
O won election 4 years ago with the support of good government Democrats. He says he's remained independent, tried to work on connecting the city to the world's economy, and hopes to be reelected. The 3 Republicans challenging O'Brien and O are all in their own way formidable. Terry Tracy is a well-spoken policy wonk and graduate of Penn's Fell School of Government, who was the party's nominee for city controller 4 years ago. He's a fan of a proposal to change the way property taxes are allocated among business and residential taxpayers, and he says the city has to think creatively about the school's financial crisis.
The reality is that we're spending $3 billion a year almost on public education, and we've raised taxes 4 times to the tune of $400 million over the last 4 years, and we're not seeing the necessary improvements in educational outcomes.
Then there's Al Taubenberger. He's run for Congress and City Council, and in 2007 was the party's candidate for mayor against Michael Nutter. So his name's been around for a while. He's likable and familiar, sort of like your favorite sandwich. In fact, visit the dining car on Frankfort Avenue near Academy, and you can order a Taubenberger.
Well, it's a wonderful thing. It's a 100% sirloin burger, which sits on top of a German potato pancake, topped with Swiss cheese and sauerkraut on a Kaiser roll.
Taubenberger is a longtime head of the Northeast Philadelphia Chamber of Commerce. He says he'll give his cell phone number to constituents and will never change it. The police and firefighter unions, among many others, have endorsed him. The 5th candidate, Dan Tinney, isn't well known, but he's backed by several construction unions who've supported him generously. This week, he's running full-page newspaper ads attacking the incumbents, Denny and O. While the 5 Republicans run against each other, they may be glancing over their shoulders at independent candidate Andrew Stober. Mayor Nutter and former Governor Ed Rendell have endorsed him, making his candidacy more formidable than most independents. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Now, 5 days out from the election, check out our voter's guide at newsworks.org/elections for the lowdown on all the races in the region. Turning to this evening's headlines, former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky is currently serving 30 to 60 years in prison for molesting boys. He was in court today for the first time since his sentencing in 2012 to request a retrial. Yesterday, Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane's office added fuel to that fire by accusing Judge Barry Feudale of leaking grand jury information to the media. Feudale oversaw the grand jury on the Sandusky case. Sandusky's attorney, Alexander Lindsay, says those leaks compromised the case.
This judge showed in these emails that he had a bias, number one. And Kathleen Kane apparently indicated that there was things that occurred improperly.
For Patterson says she believed the accusations were not related to the Sandusky trial. Starting this evening, the shoulder and right lane of I-495 North near Wilmington, Delaware, will be closed for 1 month. The Delaware Department of Transportation is shutting the lane to replace a joint in the bridge over Terminal Avenue. Charles Friel from DelDOT is urging drivers to be ready for delays.
First, just to slow down and take their time when they're going through the work zone. That's very important. And second, in the second phase, when we start having backups, if there is another route that they could use, you know, we would suggest that they use other routes.
A second lane will be shut in mid-November, leaving just one open lane on 495 North. Mostly clear skies, 64 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 620. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Clear skies, the call this evening. Low overnight, 46 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, but cooler. Friday's high, 58. Sunny Saturday, high in the mid-50s. And then clouding up on Sunday, high 62. There is a 30% chance of showers. Ahead to Monday, partly sunny, high in the low 60s. Sometimes we feel we can be a different person at work, away from our roles at home. Still ahead, we'll hear about a seasonal job that really lets this worker transform herself.
I can be someone else entirely, dressed up in costume, and have like a different personality somewhat.
Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Orchestra presents the music of George Gershwin. John Kimura Parker plays the original jazz band arrangement of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Also, Maren Alsop conducts Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony. Gershwin tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
We were curious, so we asked people whether they thought their college education was worth it.
I'm close to $80,000 in school loans, and I've been struggling trying to find work that will allow me to pay bills and to pay those loans back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The price and the value of a college education. Next time, the latest from our Marketplace Edison Research poll. It's from APM.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The most produced new play in America this theater season is called Disgraced, and one of the first productions after its appearance on Broadway is by the Philadelphia Theater Company. It's about an American Muslim lawyer who appears to be near the top of his game, and Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro says it presses a lot of hot buttons.
Ayad Akhtar's Pulitzer Prize-winning play is a rare one because it deals with being Muslim in America. Disgraced gives us characters who say things people generally will not utter in mixed company, and there's plenty of mix here. A successful Muslim American lawyer who rejects his religion, his WASP artist wife, and two colleagues, a Jewish man and his African American wife. If this sounds loaded, it is. But because each character in this highly contrived group feels real, Disgraced works, sometimes explosively. Here, at dinner, the Muslim American lawyer has just horrified everyone else at the table by admitting to a pang of pride at the 9/11 attack.
You can't help but feel just a little bit of pride. Pride? Yeah, pride. Did you feel pride on September 11th? If I'm honest, yes.
There's a plot to all this, not just political and religious-based argument. Amir, the lawyer, has a nephew, a Pakistani transplant who's become more and more disaffected in America and who convinces his uncle to appear in court in support of an imam who's been arrested. That's when things begin to unwind for Amir. The convincing actor Pej Vedat plays Amir, and Manette McGrath is his wife. Her Jewish curator, you heard him in that discussion, is Ben Graney, and all are excellent, along with Aimee Donna Kelly and Anthony Mustafa Adair. The Philadelphia Theater Company production of Disgraced is bound to be one of the most talked about this season because of its flashpoints. On Broadway last fall, the play had a funnier edge. Here, it highlights questions for all of us with a heightened intensity. How do we identify who we are and who we're not? And what happens when we're wrong? Disgraced runs at the Suzanne Roberts Theater through November 8th. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Scaring people can be fun. It can be cruel. And this time of year, scaring people can be a job. There are thousands of haunted attractions across the country, each with their own stable of monsters, ghouls, and zombies. Behind the makeup and fake blood are real people, actors. On today's recap, let's go to Frightland in Middletown, Delaware, to meet one of them.
Welcome to the manor!
Sometimes I feel like I have a personality switch where I'm like, oh, well, what can I do for you today? And then at Frightland, it just switches to, yeah, time to party! Time to get some scares on this hayride! Yeah! My name is Alyssa Alexander, and I am 21 years old. I am the detail makeup artist here at Frightland, and I also am I'm an actor out on the hayride on the Satan set. I always loved to dress up in costume because I can be someone else entirely dressed up in costume and have like a different personality somewhat. Like I could go from mild-mannered to basically insane.
Are you gonna stay? Are you gonna stay? Don't go! Don't go!
My mom told me I was diagnosed with mild autism and Asperger syndrome, so I kind of had trouble interacting with people. Mostly it's because of the way I couldn't form my words or it sounded like I was speaking gibberish, but also like my appearance, I wasn't satisfied with it. And so I was like, what if I could be something else entirely? Like, what if I could just be a different looking person for a day?
So where are you at?
I'm in the zombie prison.
All right. So zombie grueling. Ugh. So first things first, gonna darken up your eyes a bit. Oh, just like seeing their reaction is the best. Because I've grown up being like a lonely person with no social life, and just to get a reaction out of people at a job I love doing, it's amazing.
Sometimes when I transform into my Frightland self, my monster self, it is kind of easier to, you know, let go some of the things that I have bottled up inside of me all of my life that I just could not say to people normally. So it's really a great experience for, you know, getting everything out, your anxiety, your anger, your depression. It's always good to focus that into entertaining people.
What did she say? I know you've seen
someone's
her.
Someone's gonna die.
See her soon.
You're next.
I haven't really had a social life, a proper social life, until I came to Frightland. Here at Frightland, if you're weird, you're welcome. All of us are weird in a certain way, and we just learn to accept each other because of it, because of our common weirdness.
We survived!
That's actress and makeup artist Alyssa Alexander talking about her pre-Halloween work week at Frightland in Delaware. The piece was produced by Avi Wolfman Arendt. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Winter Tour presents the 52nd Annual Delaware Antiques Show, November 6th through 8th at the Chase Center on the Waterfront in Wilmington, Delaware, featuring 60 dealers specializing in American antiques and decorative arts. Highlights include a special lecture by internationally recognized interior designer and author Thomas Jane. Delaware Antiques Show details and tickets are available at 800-448-3883 or wintertour.org. Wintertour proudly supports WHYY.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.